Blog Talk Radio.
Two topics near and dear to everybody's heart. First of all, we have retired Commander Kirk Lippold, former commanding officer of the USS Cole, who's the 10th anniversary of the attack on that warship comes up here this week. And we also have coming up is Steve Phillips, author and EOD expert, as we like to call him. And just as a reminder, as with all of our guests, they're on representing themselves, not at all representing their present employment or any other organizations that they associate with. And we're really happy to have Commander Lippold on today. Part of it is, really, since a lot of our ships took some hits in the Korean War, there are very, very few U.S. commanding officers that have firsthand frontline experience in command of a ship which has been attacked and everything that goes with that. And we're coming up on the 12th of October, the 10th anniversary of the attack of his ship while in port in Aden, Sudan. The USS Cole DDG 67 was able to survive that day in no small measure, not just because of the ship's design, but because of its commanding officers, chiefs, and all the sailors on board and the extraordinary effort that they made to keep that ship afloat and to take her home. He has a very diverse background, and I think I misspoke. It was Yemen. I misspoke the country. My apologies. But Kirk's assignments include the Shiloh, the Yorktown, the Fairfax County. He was also a plank holder on the lead ship of the Arleigh Burke class, USS Arleigh Burke. And he's of that generation that before we transitioned to the reality that we have now, he caught the tail end of the Cold War. He was a part of the group that was involved with the Achille-Lauro aircraft seizure, Black Sea Freedom and Navigation operations against the Soviet Union, and also attained three combat operations in the Gulf of Sidra against Libya at the end of that era. He graduated from the Naval Academy back in 81, and he's a graduate of the Navy Postgraduate School, the United States Army Command and General Staff College, Joint Forces Command Staff College as well. He served as administrative aide to the Secretary of the Navy, and he also served on the Joint Chiefs of Staff's Director for Strategic Plans and Policy over in the J-5 shop. His last assignment was with the International Strategy Division in the Office of the Chief of Naval Operations, N-51S. Commander Lippold, he retired from the Navy back in June of 2007. And just so we don't lose it in the mix, I know many of the listeners here read the U.S. Naval Institute blog. He will have an entry tomorrow, and he'll be playing around in comments. So I'd encourage everybody to visit USNI blog tomorrow and weigh in on his observations. Kirk, welcome to MidRats.
It's great to be on, Sal. Thanks for having me tonight.
It's great, and as always, we appreciate when people take time out of their Sunday afternoons before dinner to spend times with us. And the opportunity that you bring to the show here is manyfold, but with so much concentration in the last decade, I still like to call it the Long War. Other people call it different things. But in the future, when somebody wraps it up, a historian sort of wraps up and tells this story, I think the experience of the Cole and her crew back in 2000 would really be part of the prologue in that book, because what happened to your crew really was one of the opening chapters and where we are right now. If you could take for a moment, because I know you keep in touch with your sailors there from the USS Cole. Here we are about 10 years later. How are a lot of those junior officers and junior leaders that showed their mettle with the Cole, how are they today, and where might we find some of them?
They're actually doing great, Sal. I had a wonderful opportunity last night to attend a crew reunion get-together down in Virginia Beach, and I can tell you it was smiles all around, a great chance for shipmates and friends to kind of renew contacts, and one of my sailors put it best, and it was like 10 years was yesterday, in that everyone walked in, and within about 15 minutes, it was as if we were all back together again, and the conversations took off, and nobody talked about that day. what people were talking about is what's going on in your life today. Are you married? Do you have kids? How are they doing? What are you doing for work now? I mean, it was all forward-looking, very positive, and people just had a great time. And so it's remarkable to see how that event, while it fundamentally changed who each and every one of us are and how we view life, I think that those sailors have taken that incident and have turned it into a positive force for themselves, where they have learned from it, they have gained from that experience, and it has made them far richer in how they experience and go about life today.
Well, let's set the scene about what happened on that day. So some people may not be as familiar with the details as some of the rest of us, and you certainly have the most intimate knowledge probably of what was going on. But what exactly got your ship into that position in the Port of Aden, and what happened after you got there?
Sure. We were tasked to deploy into the Middle East. We had been operating in the Mediterranean for about 6-7 weeks. When we were told go into Central Command, our mission was going to be to go to the North Arabian Gulf to enforce United Nations sanctions against the country of Iraq, mostly doing what they call visit board search and seizure operations, where we would go on vessels to ensure they were in compliance with those. When we came down, though, because the Navy had drawn down so far in ships, there was only one oiler in the region, and it was actually up in the Arabian Gulf. So we had to refuel at a port. There were only two ports available to us, Djibouti and Aden. Aden was considered the safer of the two ports. We pulled in the morning of October 12th. We set up to do refueling and had been refueling the ship for about 45 minutes when the attack occurred.
One of the things that always caught me about the experience in Aden is afterwards, a lot has been written, and a lot of people have tried to incorporate what they call, you know, the lessons learned, lessons identified from that experience. But you know, looking at it from a distance, I'm not sure that it's a situation that is easily absorbed, because when you come into a port, especially one that is neutral to friendly, and you're in a situation like that, especially in a crowded port, there really isn't much you can do to prevent a bolt out of the blue like that taking place. Do you feel those external to the situation have really pulled some of the right lessons from that experience, or are there a couple of core items there that you think they might be better off emphasizing?
I think in some cases, yes, in other cases, no. Clearly, the Navy learned from that in that they mandate all these force protection measures, but the reality of it is, while the senior leadership may say these all sound like good things to do, I like to challenge those that are out there having to live with the conditions on the waterfront to ask the question, okay, if you're given a force protection measure, how are you going to do it? What are your procedures going to be? What's the equipment available to you? How are you going to train your crew? What are the rules of engagement that are going to be allowed, whether those rules of engagement will even allow you to do that measure? And lastly is, what's the intelligence driving you there? I mean, clearly that morning when we pulled in, intelligence was lacking. I think everyone realizes that now. It's 20/20 hindsight. But the bigger problem that you have today is not just the Navy, who has worked to try and give ships some of the equipment that we clearly were lacking and didn't have that day, from things as simple as leather gloves to deal with the sharp metal to get people out of the wreckage and take care of the wounded without getting themselves hurt and cut, to the jaws of life, to some of the clothing that people wear and how we go about doing it. But I'm very concerned today that we haven't learned completely that it takes a number of people on a ship to save it. And when you look at the amount of reduced manning that the Navy has waded into, while there is some effort now to try and turn that around, I'm very concerned about the ships on the waterfront. The crews are well trained. They're going to probably be able to save that ship from its initial hit. But we were operating at times in the days that went on afterwards at the limits of our physical and mental endurance. And if you have the crews today that are smaller, you're going to be losing a larger percentage of them when you have an explosion as big as ours was. You're also going to have people that now have to stand the same number of watches for force protection, for flooding, for shoring. And if you do that, you're either going to have them standing longer watches or rotating them through watches quicker, and they're going to grow more tired. And as people know, when you're operating under those conditions for days on end and you get people that are tired, they're going to make mistakes. Not through their own fault, they're just going to be at their limits. And when you start making mistakes, that's when you have the potential to lose the ship or make a mistake if they were to do a follow-on attack. And that's what concerns me, is that the metrics that we're using to measure success are different. On the waterfront, the commanding officer is deemed successful if he can get his ship underway safely, if he can have good recruiting, if he can maintain his equipment and keep the morale up. Those in Washington, all those admirals that are up there, their metric for success is how much money can they save, how much manpower can they cut and still get the mission done, and what connections can they make inside the Pentagon and on Capitol Hill. And until those that are responsible in a Title 10 role for manning, training, and equipping our ships on the waterfront get measured by those ships and their performance, there's going to be a disconnect between the reality of the waterfront and the political world at the Pentagon and in Washington. And we need to get those two back connected again.
You know, amen. That's been a regular topic over at my home blog. I know we've also raised it over at the Naval Institute as well. And that was always the big takeaway for me from the Cole experience, that was going straight into the headwinds of what people call optimal manning. But let's be honest here, that's considered minimal manning. It's a complete peacetime mindset, short endurance mindset, and the poster child, in my opinion, is the whole concept that gave birth to LCS is almost unrecoverable, simply because of the fact that not only do you have a ship which is manned such that any type of enduring operation, you're going to burn out your watch standers and your best people, and that the ship is going to start to become uninhabitable after a while in some spaces. But more importantly, you can't even start a discussion of fighting hurt. Even a minor hit, the ship is going to be fighting just to stay afloat. And I think you're right. We have heard in the last year people are having some misgivings about this minimal manning, whether you're talking about in-serve results or some of our leaders who still have a focus on those commanding officers who are at sea trying to keep their ship going.
Absolutely. I think everyone, if you wanted to take a quick back and then we'll roll back into Cole, is if you take a look back, we're kind of rolling into that period in the late 1970s where the number of ships that were having maintenance issues on the waterfront were growing. You had crew problems on board ships because of how we were manning them, the number that we're manning. I mean, let's face it, we're 8 years into a war effort, and yet the Navy, along with the Air Force, are still providing individual augmentees to make up for shortfalls with the Army. Give me a break. I mean, that problem should have been solved. Sailors belong on ships, going to sea, doing the mission of safeguarding the sea lanes of communication for the nation's economic well-being. And the fact that we have admirals who literally have gone on record saying the U.S. Navy has no business safeguarding U.S. flag merchants on the high seas, to me is, you know, that would be a whole different topic we can get into. But when I look back on Cole and how things have evolved for us, I mean, it was a tremendously trying time. In those first few minutes after the attack, nobody could tell the crew what to do. There was no general alarm because it had been knocked offline and the backup had failed. There was no way to communicate with the crew on the announcing system and tell them what to do. And they fell back on the tried and true method of you train like you fight. And because we had trained, even with no one telling them what to do, the crew fell back on it. And literally within a couple hours, the ship was stable. As a testament to how well they did, we had 33 wounded crew members. We got off that ship in 99 minutes. And of those 33, 32 had survived. that doesn't happen without some pretty dedicated sailors that not only went through the training, but it was done so well by those chiefs and those junior officers on the ship that the crew retained it and was able to work under stressful conditions to do the phenomenal job that they did. I mean, I still couldn't be prouder of them.
Jane Novak at Armies of Liberation has a couple of posts up that are pertinent to the call. One is a post that she asserts that a Defense Intelligence Agency group identified the threat to the call a couple of weeks prior to the incident and was unable to get the warning out through the system. Do you have any comment on that?
Well, I think, again, it's a hindsight. I think there were clearly the indicators were out there. We as a Navy and as a nation had not appreciated the threat that Al-Qaeda had to us. And I think that when USS Cole was attacked, when you look at it in a larger context, when you attack buildings and you attack embassies, those are things that represent U.S. interests. When you attack a Navy warship, that is something that defends U.S. interests. And when you're attacking something that is literally trying to debilitate or degrade your capability to maintain your national interests across the world, that's an act of war. Before 9/11, there was 10/12. We fundamentally missed that signal. And I look at Cole as being the classic disconnect in national security policy across political administrations. When we got hit, the Clinton administration wanted an investigation so long as it was done before January 20th. They didn't care how it got done. Make it happen. We had the next administration that came in and essentially said we're forward-looking, not backward-acting. They did nothing related to coal. And so consequently, nothing happened, and the nation paid a tragic price on 9/11. Now we've rolled into an administration that says, we don't even know what to call this thing, whether it's the war on terror, the long war, the war against radical Islam, overseas contingency operations. They haven't really defined what we're doing. And yet we're still out there with hundreds of thousands of troops in the field fighting to defend our national interests. But yet we're not really coming to grips with it as a Navy in that we still have a job to do being out there patrolling those sea lanes and keeping them secure. And the strategy, I don't think, is really understood by a lot of people in what is our Navy doing to protect our national interests today. And our leadership needs to do that.
Yeah, I think the messaging is absolutely critical to tell that story and how you do it and trying to get the whole mechanism to try to get that message out, or the funding, when it comes under pressure, is just going to go away. But when you started off with your comment, you mentioned, you know, hindsight and looking back, and that's always problematic. But, you know, something's happened recently here that, you know, we can be responsible for what we're doing today. And, you know, we're looking 10 years back, and something that, to use one of my favorite words, just leaves me gobsmacked, and I really don't know how to respond to it. But Abd al-Rahim al-Nashiri, there I got the word out, we've had him in Gitmo since 06. He's the alleged mastermind of the attack on the coal. And in late August, the Justice Department filed a motion where they said no charges are either pending or contemplated with respect to al-Nashiri in the near future. They shifted the timeline to the right. And this takes place even though back in June of 08, Brigadier General Hartman announced that they were going to bring charges against Nashiri, organizing, directing the bombing plot, and DOD would seek the death penalty. What is wrong with our entire governmental system where it takes a decade to decide to do nothing? And how does the crew of the coal and their families look at this inability of our government to do what could be argued is a basic fundamental function?
I can tell you right now firsthand that the families and the crew, first, they're discouraged. They're discouraged because they have seen promises made by the administration and nothing done. You had a president that sat with the families in February of 2009, right after he took office, and explained why he was closing Guantanamo, why he was conducting a review, and why he had put a freeze on all military commissions. Since then, in November of 2009, there appeared to be movement when the Attorney General, who had met with a number of additional victims of terrorism, 9/11, Bali, the embassy bombings, and Cole, in June, said, we're going to move forward. In November, the Attorney General himself says al-Nashiri is the, or al-Nashiri is actually the correct pronunciation, al-Nashiri is the poster child case for why we should keep the military commission system alive. Well, Mr. Attorney General, it's a year later. We're still waiting. And the only reason we're waiting is because of politics. National security issues like this being beholden to politics, we've lived through it once, through two administrations, now our third. Enough is enough. Justice delayed is justice denied. These families deserve to move forward. The military commission's process is a proper venue. It is recognized in international law. It is recognized by the laws of armed conflict. And we need to start holding these people, these terrorists who murder our citizens, accountable.
Yeah, speaking of justice denied, there is a report, unconfirmed as of yet, that the Cole bomber Fahd al-Quzo, whatever his name is, may have been killed in Pakistan, apparently by one of the predators, hellfire type things. I don't know if you'd heard of that, but perhaps that's some, that's a ray of sunshine in this otherwise unpleasant episode.
Well, we're keeping our fingers crossed. I had seen that report and kicked it out to a bunch of folks. I think there's still some verification issues going on. I'm hopeful, but as always, until we have irrefutable proof, you always have to wonder. And, you know, these days I just grow increasingly concerned that we are using the Predator drone strikes as an easy way to solve that short-term dilemma of how to try and eliminate the threat of al-Qaeda, when in fact the longer-term safe issue would be to capture some of these guys and interrogate them and use the information they get. I mean, had it not been the capture of that individual over in Afghanistan, we might not have been tipped off about the pending attacks that drove the security issues recently in Europe. And if you don't capture some of these people instead of just dropping a hellfire on their mud hut, you're eventually going to get caught with your pants down around your ankles again, wondering how did this happen? And the reality of it is you have to wage war across the full spectrum of tools available to you. In the case of USS Cole, we clearly did not recognize that we were in a state of war with al-Qaeda when we pulled into that port that morning. We pulled in under what was then called Threat Condition Bravo, now Force Protection Condition Bravo, when it was actually a Force Protection Condition Delta. It was imminent if it hadn't occurred already. They had actually made an attempt in January against the USS, the Sullivans, and we never picked up on that within the intelligence community, not just within the Navy and the defense, but our national intelligence failed as well, and consequently, without knowing it, they regrouped, moved to another safe house, built that boat that would ultimately come out to us, masquerading as the third garbage barge.
There, in the areas between Yemen and the Horn of Africa, obviously one of the big topics the last few years has been piracy. And I think you can boil down the arguments on piracy into, you know, two major schools of thought. One, it's all economic. And the other said, well, yes, there's some economics to it, but there's also the fact that is a lawless area that's generating income through piracy, and it's radical Islamists that are benefiting from it. Do you have some thoughts on how the Navy's approach to piracy has evolved over the last, let's call it, 3 years? And are there some things that we are fundamentally being prevented to do that have to do with, say, politics or lawfare that somehow we need to push through?
Well, I think it's a matter of resources and the money you want to invest. I mean, you touched on a couple points, and I'll go through them very quickly. Number one, piracy is an incredibly successful and lucrative business model. That's really what it comes down to for those folks. They grab a ship using relatively crude weapons and rocket-propelled grenades. They get on board very quickly. They grab the ship. They hold it for millions of dollars of ransom that is eventually paid after negotiation with the shipping company and the crew of the families of the crew members they're holding. And guess what? Ship's released. Crew's unharmed. They've made a few million dollars. Life's good. Regarding supporting the Islamic radical Islam in that region of the world, there's some connections, but they're really not as solid as people would like to make them out to be. It's more of a business model, to be actually truthful about it. The next point is resources. Hey, we can solve the problem. If you build a surveillance picture over that area, whether it is using unmanned aircraft to monitor, whether it is determining how those boats launch from, face it, they have to launch from a port somewhere. They can't sustain themselves at sea indefinitely, which means that we learn where they come from, and then we learn who are the people that are actually doing it, and we make arrangements. If it's so lawless, then we should be able to put teams on, go in an international operation, and rescue every one of those crews that are currently being held. The reality of it is, if you raise the threshold on the business model where people that engage in piracy suddenly find themselves getting killed because we have got unmanned predators flying over the area in a surveillance picture observing their movements and can stop them, trust me, it will stop. We have been unwilling, not only just in the United States politically, but internationally, to do any more than put a large force out there that is nothing, doing nothing realistically except boring some holes in the ocean, doing very little to interdict the piracy problem that is still ongoing. While it is decreased, it has begun to increase lately, and it is moving further out to sea, which means they're gaining in capability, they're gaining in their own organic intelligence capability to reach out and determine where these vessels are going to be vulnerable and they can capture them. And until we invest in the surveillance and raising the price on that business model through, in my opinion, military means, which means killing some of these people, we are going to continue to have a problem in that part of the world of piracy, and we should not put up with it.
Well, one of the arguments against taking a strong stand against the pirates and the small boats themselves is that they're 17, 18-year-old kids who are really irrelevant to the problem, other than that they're the bodies, but that the money, the people who are making the money, are the people back on shore, and that the only way to effectively stop the piracy in the area is to stop it, what's happening on the land, and that's a much more complicated picture given our history in Somalia. What's your take on that?
I couldn't agree more. I think it needs to be twofold. You need to eliminate their capability at sea, but you also have to eliminate their ability to resource them from ashore. You determine, I briefly mentioned it, and my fault for not going into that a little further, once you determine where they're coming from, you begin to build the picture of where they're resourced from ashore, how are they supplying themselves, who are the people that are doing the crew, and you can build that surveillance picture without necessarily putting boots on the ground. And then once you do it, you have the ability to project power ashore in order to stop it. And I agree. We are going to have to take it above the level of those people that are being used as the, you know, it's kind of like the drug war. Don't take out the mules. Go back to the guy that is actually cultivating it, to the guy that is selling it, to the guy that's processing it, and hit them where it's initiated, not when it's finally at the end product stage. And it's the same with piracy. Couldn't agree with you more.
And on that note, I think that was a very quick half hour we've spent the last half hour with Commander Kirk Lippold, United States Navy retired, a commanding officer of the USS Cole back in 2000 when she was struck. I wanted to thank you very much for taking 30 minutes out of your day. And I know you have a post coming over at the USNI blog tomorrow. If people would be interested in hearing more about your ideas and some of your thoughts, not just on what happened with the Cole, but in a larger sense, would be a good place for them to find you.
Probably the best way is I work for an organization now called Military Families United, and they can go on the web at militaryfamiliesunited.org, and they've got a way to contact the group. But if anyone needs to pass anything, that is probably the easiest way to do it. So militaryfamiliesunited.org, and when they get on there, they'll see what we're all about, and a great organization that truly works to try and help shape national security policy on behalf of the soldiers, sailor, airmen, Marines out in the field and the families who live with the consequences of policy decisions.
Thank you for joining us, Commander Lipley.
Absolutely. It's a pleasure to be on, Sal. Thank you.
And just for everybody that's checking in late, you are listening to MidRats. I am Sal from the blog Commander Salamander, along with my ever-genial host, Eagle One of Eagle Speak. And just one last note on our previous guest. If you hear more, which you should, coming up over the next few days about the 10th anniversary of the Cole, make sure and use that as an opportunity to talk about that experience and what we can take from it. Because there are still, 10 years later, a lot about what happened that can inform us not just for those professional military people, but also from a political and a global strategy point of view. But now we're going to move on to the second half of the show with our guest, Steve Phillips, another Naval Academy graduate, but we're going to slide over another decade. He graduated from the Naval Academy in 1992. After he left Annapolis, he found honest work as a SWO, but then he seemed to have taken an off-ramp someplace and found gainful employment elsewhere, over in the EOD side of the world. He has experience with EOD Mobile Unit 6, 8, and 10, but he is also an author of the book Proximity, a novel of the Navy's elite bomb squad that received the gold medal from the Military Writers Society in 2008, and you can find links to the book over at my home blog, but you can also do a Google search on his name and his book, and he has his own blog out there, which I'd invite you to visit and read some of his thoughts on a little broader subject area. A little note about Proximity is a portion of all the proceeds from that book are going to go to support the EOD Memorial Foundation that provides scholarships to the children of EOD technicians who have made the ultimate sacrifice in service to our country. And if you also like his work, he has a nonfiction book coming out. Has an improvised working title of improvised EOD Techs in the War on Terrorism. I have links where you can read some of the introductory work to that over at my home blog. Go over there, give it a click, give it a read. But we'll talk about that down the road. But Steve, welcome to MidRats.
Great, Commander Salamander. Thank you very much for having me tonight.
Oh, glad to have you. First off, just on my personal side of the house, is my first exposure to the EOD back in the 90s on the Big E, is I ran into you guys, and I was just sitting there around the table, and I said, okay, I get the SEAL guys. I know the SEAL debt, what they're all about, but who are you guys? Why do you have MP5s, and what actually do you do on the Enterprise? And just kind of as an introduction there, EOD on a ship, on an aircraft carrier, has a significant responsibility. How did they get to that point? Why does the Navy need them there? And what are some of their primary duties that an EOD at sea will do?
Right. So EOD techs, our primary mission, no matter where we are, is to render safe ordnance of any category. So it can be conventional, chemical, biological, nuclear, and naturally the well-known IEDs, improvised explosive devices. And so EOD techs deployed on the Big E, as you said, and still to this day deploy on board aircraft carriers and also with amphibs. And back in the day, they used to deploy also on the ammunition ships, the AOEs and the AEs, in order to first be ready to respond to any issues with the ordnance on board. And especially in the days when ships were carrying nuclear weapons, they naturally had to be ready to respond to those especially. So you can imagine that, for example, if there was an aircraft accident on board and, say, the bombs had to be rendered safe before they could extract people from the aircraft. Likewise, other explosive components on the aircraft, like the ejection seats, would actually be an EOD guy that responds to that with the other air crewmen that are on the deck that do that. In fact, you'd see an EOD guy sometimes walking around the flight deck with a, one of those red slope coats with a with the EOD crab on the back of it. But there's a lot more to it than that. EOD technicians do operate with the Naval Special Warfare guys. And so, for example, Commander Lippold was talking about doing operations in the Northern Arabian Gulf. Whenever there was boardings that required Naval Special Warfare, the SEALs, to go on board, they would always take two EOD technicians to go with them. Because EOD techs are trained to use all the means of insertion that our Naval Special Warfare brethren are, to parachute, to fast rope, to rappel. And so they would take two EOD techs with them to be able to render safe any ordnance items they might find on board the ship. They could also then render safe or respond to any booby traps that are on board. Let's say that they wanted the terrorists wanted to booby trap one of the holds or a particular piece of cargo. And then finally, as you can imagine, if you find any ordnance on board, EOD techs are trained in the first basic response intelligence gathering of that so that we can decide what's the next step to respond to it. So it's a wide variety from responding to emergencies to also bringing a capability to render something safe in order to protect your shipmates.
Well, this is Eagle One. As an old ammunition ship sailor, I used to go. I appreciate the EOD teams we used to have on board, and I used to go diving for lobsters with them, although my equipment seemed to be better there in some ways. How did you move from the SWO world into the EOD world, and do you have any regrets in doing so?
I do not. In order to transfer over, I had to apply for lateral transfer. Our Navy was configured a little bit differently. Back then, the salvage ships were, we still had many of those on the waterfront. Some of you may or may not be aware, we're down to four, and they're all now USNS ships, so they have civilian mariners as their crews. But at that time, the Navy's EOD community for the officer corps, we were called Special Operations Officer, and you had to have the skill sets for diving and salvage as well as explosive ordnance disposal. What that meant was that young officers went to dive school first and became qualified as a basic diving officer and as a salvage officer and would serve a first tour aboard one of those salvage ships. Then at about the Lieutenant JG or young lieutenant point, they would go to EOD school and then serve in EOD billets after that. And there were some guys, as you can imagine, would go on through EOD the rest of their career. Some would go back and forth. But as a result of that, it made it very easy for a surface warfare officer to lateral transfer into the community because it was still a requirement to be surface warfare qualified. And some folks might be familiar with the special operations warfare device of the time. Basically, it was a surface warfare pin, but it integrated the Mark V dive helmet and the EOD crab. So when I actually applied twice. I was first on Harlan County. She decommissioned, and I applied for lateral transfer and did not get picked up the first time. I went to San Jacinto, and I applied from Sanjac, and then I got picked up. So then when I arrived in Panama City to go to dive school, I was there with, there were six guys that were picked up for lateral transfer that year. We went through the basic diving officer course. We went through the salvage course. And then when we reported aboard at Explosive Ordnance Disposal School at Eglin Air Force Base, the rest of our brethren that had basically served their first shipboard tour on a salvage ship were joining us at that point. So it allowed us to have a seamless integration with them, and in effect, we didn't lose anything as far as our career track. The only thing that we didn't have was specific salvage experience that they did. So what's interesting is now in the Navy, it's come full circle in that, as I described, because the salvage Navy is now crewed by civilian mariners, and we've changed the name for the officer community is now called Explosive Ordnance Disposal. And, in fact, the warfare device is now the EOD crab that's gold instead of the old silver style. So as a result, their career path looks very different, and they don't do sort of the surface applied diving stuff anymore.
On October 13th, you're going to be part of a panel over at the Navy Memorial on EOD then and now. And you've kind of started to touch on that, I think. If people just had a snapshot of EOD that was, you know, pre-2001, so to speak, and you wanted to give them a snapshot of where they are right now, what is the big difference in emphasis or skill sets that they have now that they perhaps didn't have earlier?
Absolutely. I would say that it's not that we have a new skill set as much as our skill sets in improvised explosive devices has gotten much more sophisticated because of the war on terror. EOD techs, as far back as the earlier eras, had to respond to IEDs, but now it is the weapon of choice in the irregular fight that we're involved in. One of the phrases that I've used in the book that I'm developing, Improvised, that you guys mentioned before, is I say that the IED is the device that's at the line of scrimmage in this current conflict. And it's the EOD tech that is right there at the center that has to respond to that. And I have a notion that we'll look back on this conflict, and especially the period in Iraq, and look at it as an IED insurgency. That's another phrase that I use. So the EOD techs today are much more savvy for IED response. They have a lot more experience than the people of my time period did. Another statistic that I've shared with folks, as I was developing that book, one of the EOD techs that I interviewed, I asked him, I said, so how many IEDs did you defuse in your 6-month deployment to Iraq? And he said, 127. And I said, wow, 127, that's a lot for an EOD team to do. And he said, well, no, Steve, you asked me how many did. He said, my team disarmed 496. I personally disarmed 127. So we've gotten to a point where I think when we started the counter-IED fight in the summer of 2003, American EOD techs didn't necessarily have the experience, say, of our UK brethren who had been fighting an IED fight in Northern Ireland. Now I would say that our EOD techs are ahead of the game and have more experience than our UK brethren.
One of the articles that you wrote for the Long War Journal, which I gather is part of the improvised book that you're writing, has to do with the I'll say combined or joint EOD effort in this war. Could you kind of discuss that a little bit?
Absolutely. The article is called "The Birth of the Combined Explosive Exploitation Cell," which is short, because the acronym spells out SEXY, C-E-X-C. And what that was our first effort to collect intelligence on IEDs in Iraq in an attempt to first try to make sure that we were giving information to the EOD community so that members of the community could respond more accurately as they saw devices, and also so that we could try to use the devices to try to track down the bombers or the bomb makers. One of the specific examples that I share in that is let me stop and say first, that as the team came together, it was a mixed group. So there was a U.S. Navy EOD officer who was the lead. There were folks from the Defense Intelligence Agency. There were some engineers involved. There was ATO, Ammunition Technical Officer, which is what the British called their EOD technicians, and not in the initial stages, but eventually we ended up adding people from the FBI and a myriad of other three-letter agencies. So they basically started to figure out, how do we get ahead of this game? How do we gather intelligence to be able to pass on to other EOD techs in the theater so they know how to defuse some of these devices that they see, and how do we use the information that we can gather from those devices to track down the bombers themselves. And one of the first cases that became relatively well-known, perhaps infamous should be the term, was the attack on the Al-Rashid Hotel in the fall, I believe it was October 23rd of 2003, when Paul Wolfowitz was there. And it wasn't actually an IED, it was an improvised rocket launcher. And so as an example, when the launcher, after the attack, this first group of the SEXY guys approached the launcher, and they began to break it down and try to figure out how it worked. and they took it back to their shop and said, okay, how do we gather information from this to try to figure out who did this, who's behind this particular attack? And what's interesting in that particular case is, as they looked at it, somebody sat back and said, you know, in how many welding shops in Baghdad have the sophistication to make the welds on this particular rocket launcher, because it looked very sophisticated. And that was how they ended up eventually rolling up the bombing IED cell. They went to these various welding shops. They started watching the people at those shops. They identified one in which they thought it might be the folks. And as you pull the string, one thing leads to another, and they ended up rolling up an 18-man cell. And as they rolled them up, they ended up capturing, as you can imagine, then it meant more intelligence, more weapons. So that was sort of their first hallmark, high-profile collection that demonstrated their capability. And from there, Sexy has done phenomenally well, and they're a very important tool in the war on terrorism.
There's another article you penned when we had Kirk on before. We were going back to the beginning of this conflict, but over on Small Wars Journal, you had an article about a remembrance of 9/11. And again, people can find the link over at my home blog, but for those that haven't had a chance to read it yet, could you give us a real quick overview of what you discussed in that article?
Absolutely. This is a phenomenal story. It covers, at the time he was Bosun's mate chief, I think, Jim Pruitt. And Jim, incidentally, was one of my instructors when I went through EOD school. And he heard that I was working on this book, and you know, the word has gotten out. And he actually contacted me and said, hey, Steve, I have a couple stories that I'd be willing to contribute if you're willing to hear them. And I said, sure. And so Jim is going to turn out, at this point, I have three chapters that cover his actions in the war on terror. But this first one was an iconic one, and as he and I went through it, we decided that I would try to publish it first as an article in the Small Wars Journal on the anniversary of this year, the 9th anniversary of 9/11. At the time, Jim was actually performing a mission in which EOD technicians assist the U.S. Secret Service in bomb search capabilities. And one of the things that we support them every year is in September is the UN General Assembly. And so Jim and his team from EOD Mobile Unit 6, and when they do Secret Service work, they're wearing civilian clothes. They were arriving underneath World Trade Center Tower 1 shortly after the initial attack. And so they immediately were told what was going on. They pulled out their credentials and showed it to the police officers, and they offered to assist them. And so they were assisting the police in evacuating people and crowd control and whatnot. And so what's most sort of iconic from that day, there's two events that are really interesting that I've shared with people, is after helping everybody evacuate and such, Jim went to one of the command centers. And as he went to the command center, the one tower was starting to fall, and he had no place to go. He couldn't figure out where he was going to go in the amount of time as the tower fell. He ended up slipping into a phone booth, and it's not the old-style Superman phone booth where it covers your legs. It's just like the eggshell above you. And so he was suddenly enveloped in gas and fire and everything else, and he had a moment where he heard pieces of material that were so large going by him and loud cracks and pops and everything else that he thought, I'm going to lose one of my legs. And he said to himself, I need to decide which one of my legs I'm going to lose. You can't make this up, right? And he ended up saying, he said, I would rather, if I'm going to lose one of my limbs, I'd rather lose my left leg and keep my right leg. So he stood like a pelican and pulled his right leg up into his chest, you know, so he could try to reduce his surface area. After the dust settled, Jim then went and walked down the down Vesey Street. And what he reports is at that time it was very clear that Tower 1 was going to fall. If you remember, Tower 2 was hit second, fell first. Everybody now knows that Tower 1 is going to fall. And And Jim says that he looked and saw as a group of firemen were putting on their Scott Air packs and looking at each other in that one final moment before they went into Tower One. And he said they clearly knew what they were about to face and that they were not going to come out. And I wanted to make sure that that got published, and Jim wanted to make sure it got published this year on the anniversary because we wanted to make sure that people don't forget.
I think that was there are lots of vignettes and stories about that, you know, 9 years later that so many people don't even know existed. And you're right, people need to be reminded that what that started, or at least brought to our attention, continues on. And we continue to have a good combination of lucky and a good combination of good that our nation hasn't had to face that again. But there are people around the world that are doing all they can to bring that back to us, and it could be tomorrow. Eagle One.
Steve, to kind of change the subject slightly, do EOD team members get nicknames, and are there ones you don't want, like Shaky or Fat Fingers or things like that?
Yes, EOD, it's not like... it's not like the aviators that have call signs, but yes, EOD techs do have nicknames, and there are some nicknames that you do not want to have. Yeah, that's true. I'm not sure I can repeat them on the air, but I find it amusing that I think, much like in the surface warfare community, you know, you have a chief engineer on board, and I think there are some people that don't realize that the guy's name isn't Chang, but that's his, you know, that's his moniker, as it were. So yeah, but we definitely do have things like that, LT and Ray Ray, and there's a whole bunch of nicknames that come through. So it's one of the things I do highlight in my book. A couple of the guys have nicknames. One of the guys, his nickname is T-Ball, for example. So yeah.
You mentioned earlier your British, or the British counterparts to the EOD specialty. Are there other navies that have, I know all navies have some people who have that job responsibility, and a lot of it has to do with our economies of scale that we have in our Navy. But besides the British that most people are familiar with, have you had an opportunity to work with some of our friends and allies in their EOD units? And did you see in either the way that they did things or some of the techniques that they use that are valuable and that we've brought into how we do business?
Yes. One of the things that's interesting is for the U.S. Navy, we're the only EOD technicians in the world that have EOD as sort of our primary mission. So one of the things that's interesting is there's nobody else out there that's like us that has the wide breadth of, you know, the diving, EOD, all of the mission scopes, et cetera. So as an example, in the British Navy, if you work with an EOD tech equivalent, an ammunition technical officer, that's a logistics corps officer who has trained in EOD as a separate mission. If you work with their divers who dive in minefields and clear mines, that's a clearance diver. So the clearance divers don't necessarily get IED training, for example, until later on in their career. The Germans are much the same. They have a three-tiered process where you start off your clearance diver. A little bit later in your career, you get more training to become like an ordnance, to respond to ordnance accidents. So they all respond differently in how they train their folks. But it is true that in operating with each of them, you can get some valuable insight from them. When I was at Mobile Unit 6 in Ingleside, Texas, at the time it was the Mine Warfare Center of Excellence, and a lot of the Northern European navies especially are really big on mine warfare. And so as an example, we had liaisons down there. We had a French clearance diver officer. We had a British. We had there was Dutch. And then in my career, I've worked with the Greeks. I've worked with Germans. And they're all great folks, and they all have interesting ideas. I can't think of anything specifically that I've adopted that's right now, but I can tell you that we have shared information. I have taken on board some of their ideas. And so it's valuable to have that interaction with our fellow navies. The Royal Australian Navy is another one. The Royal Australian Navy guys are great at underwater warfare. Those guys are professionals. So
they're good on liberty too.
Absolutely.
When you when you were at the academy, what did you major in? A lot of times they used to tell me for some of these diving billets you had to have a technical degree.
Right. No, I majored in political science. So.
Well, that's highly technical.
Yeah, so I was a bull. I was a bull major.
Yeah, it's funny. That's one thing we've talked about a lot on my home blog is always the emphasis on the technical. And we've had a guest on a couple of times. One is a midshipman, and he's now an ensign. He's a nuclear power school, and he has a degree in history of all things, which I always find humorous. You come out of the Naval Academy with a BS in history, which is kind of repeating yourself in many respects. Eagle One, do you have another question?
No, I really don't. I just have this image of the days after Desert Storm when the people were cleaning up the landmines left behind by the Iraqis, and they seemed to have hired a whole bunch of Bangladeshis with sticks to go out and do the work. Do you ever envision that kind of work?
I actually thought of that at different times and thus far have not been involved in that myself. There's a lot of VOD techs who get into that. UXO is what they call it, where you're sort of post-conflict cleaning up after stuff that's been littered out there. And it can be anything from blowing up ammunition dumps to clearing minefields and things like that. Those guys get paid very well, but it's like being in the military. You're gone all the time. And just like the rest of the EOD field, as you can imagine, you really need to trust the folks that you work with. Some of those guys that, as you said, and you're right, you're absolutely right, probing the dirt with sticks trying to find something. Some of them really know what they're doing and truly have a delicate touch. There's others that are just, they're there because it's the only work they can find, and so you really have to be careful about who you associate with. But I myself have not delved into that.
Well, I have some great video that the Army EOD guys shared with me right after Desert Storm as they were out blowing up massive ammo dumps. Someday, if I ever meet you in person, I'll show you those because I'm sure you don't see enough stuff exploding. So,
Absolutely. I call it EOD porn, you know. I always love watching stuff blow up.
Yeah, I was about to say, based upon the EOD guy I was with at the on the Big E, I don't think we'd want to show his videos to very many people. But, hey, we're coming up with 1 minute left. I just wanted to, first of all, say thank you very much, Steve, for coming in this Sunday afternoon. And you also have your own blog. I wanted to give you a chance to mention that. And also give us one more plug if people want to read more about what you have to say.
Sure, absolutely. My blog is stephen-phillips.blogspot.com. And I hope that you guys, if you keep watching the blog and the Small Wars Journal, you can hear about my book that will be coming out in the future, Improvised EOD Techs in the War on Terrorism. And if you just Google it or you go on Amazon or any of the other bookstores, you can find Proximity, a novel of the Navy's elite bomb squad. And, again, it benefits the EOD Memorial Foundation. So, gents, thank you very much for having me today. I really appreciate spending this evening with you.
Thank you very much, Steve.
Thank you, Steve.
And thank you very much, everybody, for listening live. Have a great Navy Day.
Goodbye, Piccadilly, farewell, dear.